Manfred was given paper and crayons to amuse himself, and then the two men set out to search for a suitable spot at which to drive the stake. The spot, a low plateau, was found, and the stake was driven, mostly by Jack. His father wandered about, inspecting rock formations and plants, with a clearly irritated and impatient frown. He did not seem to enjoy it here in this uninhabited region. However, he said nothing. He politely took note of a fossil formation, which Jack pointed out to him. They took photographs of the stake and the surrounding area, and then, their business done, they returned to the copter. There sat Manfred, on the ground, busily drawing with the crayons. The desolation of the area did not seem to bother him, Jack decided. The boy, wrapped up in his inner world, drew and ignored them. He glanced up now and then, but not at the two men. His eyes were blank. "What's he drawing?" Jack wondered, and walked around behind the boy to see. Manfred, glancing up now and then to peer sightlessly at the landscape around him, had drawn great flat apartment buildings. "Look at this, Dad," Jack said, and he managed to keep his voice calm and steady. Together, the two of them stood behind the boy, watching him draw, watching the buildings become more and more distinct on the paper. "Well, there's no mistaking it," Jack thought. "The boy is drawing the buildings that will be here. He is drawing the landscape which will come, not the landscape visible to our eyes." "I wonder if he saw the photo I showed you," Leo said. "That one of the models." "Maybe so," Jack said. It would provide an explanation. The boy had understood their conversation, seen the papers, gotten his inspiration from that. But the photo had shown the buildings from above. It was a different perspective from this. The boy had sketched the buildings as they would appear to an observer on the ground, as they would appear, Jack realized, to someone seated where we are right now. "I wouldn't be surprised if you've got something in this time theory," Leo said. He glanced at his wristwatch. "Now, speaking of time, I'd say..." "Yes," Jack agreed thoughtfully. "We'll get started back." There was something more in the child's drawing which he had noticed. He wondered if his father had seen it. The buildings, the enormous co-op apartments which the boy was sketching, were developing in an ominous direction before their eyes. As they watched, they saw some final details which made Leo glare. He snorted and glanced at his son. The buildings were old, sagging with age. Their foundations showed great cracks radiating upward. Windows were broken, and what looked like stiff, tall weeds grew in the land around. It was a scene of ruin and despair, and of a ponderous, timeless, inertial heaviness. "Jack, he's drawing a slum," Leo exclaimed. That was it, a decaying slum. Buildings that had stood for years, perhaps even decades, which had passed their prime and dwindled into their twilight, into senility and partial abandonment. Pointing at a yawning crack which he had just drawn, Manfred said, "Gubbish." His hand traced the weeds, the broken windows. Again he said, "Gubbish." He glanced at them, smiling in a frightened way. "What does that mean, Manfred?" Jack asked. There was no answer. The boy continued to sketch, and as he sketched, the buildings before their eyes grew older and older, more in ruins with each passing moment. "Let's go," Leo said hoarsely. Jack took the boy's paper and crayons and got him on his feet. The three of them re-entered the copter. "Look, Jack," Leo said. He was intently examining the boy's drawing. "What he's written over the entrance of the building." In twisted, wavering letters, Manfred had written, "Amweb, A-M-W-E-B. "Must be the name of the building," Leo said. "It is," Jack said, recognizing the word. It was a contraction of a co-op slogan. "Alle Menschen werden Brüder." "All men become brothers," he said under his breath. "It's on co-op stationery." He remembered it well. Now, taking his crayons once more, Manfred resumed his work. As the two men watched, the boy began to draw something at the top of the picture. Dark birds, Jack saw. Enormous, dusky, vulture-like birds. At a broken window of the building, Manfred drew a round face with eyes, nose, a turned-down, despairing mouth. Someone within the building, gazing out silently and hopelessly, as if trapped within. "Well," Leo said. "Interesting." His expression was one of grim outrage. Now, why would he want to draw that? I don't think that's a very wholesome or positive attitude. Why can't he draw it like it's going to be new and immaculate, with children playing and pets and contented people? Jack said, maybe he draws what he sees. Well, if he sees that, he's ill, Leo said. There are so many bright, wonderful things he could see instead. Why would he want to see that? Perhaps he has no choice, Jack said. Gubbish, he thought. I wonder, could gubbish mean time? The force that to the boy means decay, deterioration, destruction, and at last death? The force at work everywhere on everything in the universe? And is that all he sees? If so, Jack thought, no wonder he's autistic. No wonder he can't communicate with us. A view of the universe that partial? It isn't even a complete view of time. Because time also brings new things into existence. It's also the process of maturation and growth. And evidently Manfred does not perceive time in that aspect. Is he sick because he sees this? Or does he see this because he is sick? A meaningless question, perhaps, or anyhow one that can't be answered. This is Manfred's view of reality, and according to us he is desperately ill. He does not perceive the rest of reality, which we do. And it is a dreadful section which he does see, reality in its most repellent aspect. Jack thought, and people talk about mental illness as an escape. He shuddered. It was no escape. It was a narrowing, a contracting of life into, at last, a moldering, dank tomb, a place where nothing came or went, a place of total death. The poor damned kid, he thought. How can he live from one day to the next, having to face the reality he does? Somberly, Jack returned to the job of piloting the copter. Leo looked out the window, contemplating the desert below. Manfred, with the taut, frightened expression on his face, continued to draw. They gubbled and gubbled. He put his hands to his ears, but the product crept up through his nose. Then he saw the place. It was where he wore out. They threw him away there, and gubbish lay in heaps up to his waist. Gubbish filled the air. What is your name?
Steiner, Manfred.
Age?
83.
Vaccinated against smallpox?
Yes.
Any venereal diseases?
Well, a little clap, that's all.
VD clinic for this man.
Sir, my teeth, they're in the bag along with my eyes.
Your eyes, oh yes. Give this man his teeth and eyes before you take him to the VD clinic. How about your ears, Steiner?
Got them on, sir. Thank you, sir.
They tied his hands with gauze to the sides of the bed because he tried to pull out the catheter. He lay facing the window, seeing through the dusty, cracked glass. Outside, a bug on tall legs picked through the heaps. It ate, and then something squashed it and went on, leaving it squashed with its dead teeth sunk into what it had wanted to eat. Finally, its dead teeth got up and crawled out of its mouth in different directions. He lay there for 123 years, and then his artificial liver gave out, and he fainted and died. By that time, they had removed both his arms and legs up to the pelvis because those parts of him had decayed. He didn't use them anyhow, and without arms he didn't try to pull the catheter out, and that pleased them.
"I've been at Amweb for a long time," he said. "Maybe you can get me a transistor radio so I can tune in Friendly Fred's Breakfast Club. I like to hear the tunes. They play a lot of the old-time favorites."
"Something outside gives me hay fever. Must be those yellow flowering weeds. Why did they let them get so tall? I once saw a ball game."
For 2 days he lay on the floor in a big puddle, and then the landlady found him and called for the truck to bring him here. He snored all the way. It woke him up. When they tried to give him grapefruit juice, he could only work one arm. The other never worked again, ever. He wished he could still make those leather belts. They were fun and took lots of time. Sometimes he sold them to people who came by on the weekend.
"Do you know who I am, Manfred?" "No." "I'm Arnie Cott." "Why don't you laugh or smile sometimes, Manfred? Don't you like to run around and play?"
As he spoke, Mr. Cott gubbled from both his eyes.
"Obviously he doesn't, Arnie, but that's not what concerns us here anyhow." "What do you see, Manfred? Let us in on what you see. All those people, are they going to live there? Is that it? Is that right, Manfred? Can you see lots of people living there?"
He put his hands over his face and the gubble stopped.
"I don't see why this kid never laughs."
Gubble, gubble. Chapter 10. Inside Mr. Cott's skin were dead bones, shiny and wet. Mr. Cott was a sack of bones, dirty and yet shiny wet. His head was a skull that took in greens and bit them. Inside him, the greens became rotten things as something ate them to make them dead. He could see everything that went on inside Mr. Cott, the teeming, gubbish life. Meanwhile, the outside said, "I love Mozart. I'll put this tape on." The box read, "Symphony 40 in G-Moll K550. Mr. Cott fiddled with the knobs of the amplifier. "Bruno Walter conducting," Mr. Cott told his guests. "A great rarity from the golden age of recordings." A hideous racket of screeches and shrieks issued from the speakers like the convulsions of corpses. Mr. Cott shut off the tape transport. "Sorry," he muttered. It was an old coded message from Rockingham or Scott Temple or Anne, from someone anyhow. Mr. Cott, he knew that. He knew that by accident it had found its way into his library of music. Sipping her drink, Doreen Anderton said, "What a shock! You should spare us, Arnie, your sense of humor." "An accident," Arnie Cott said angrily. He rummaged for another tape. "Aw, the hell with it," he thought. "Listen, Jack," he said, turning. "I'm sorry to make you come here when I know your dad's visiting, but I'm running out of time. Show me your progress with the Steiner boy, okay?" His anticipation and concern made him stutter. He looked at Jack expectantly. But Jack Bolin hadn't heard him. He was saying something to Doreen there on the couch where the two of them sat together. "We're out of booze," Jack said, setting down his empty glass. "God's sake," Arnie said. "I gotta hear how you've done, Jack. Can't you give me anything? Are you two just going to sit there necking and whispering? I don't feel good." He went unsteadily into the kitchen where Heliogabalus sat on a tall stool, like a dunce, reading a magazine. "Fix me a glass of warm water and baking soda," Arnie said.
"Yes, mister."
Heliogabalus closed his magazine and stepped down from the stool.
"I overheard. Why don't you send them out? They are no good. No good at all, mister."
From the cabinet over the sink, he took the package of bicarbonate of soda. He spooned out a teaspoonful. "Who cares about your opinion?" Arnie said. Doreen entered the kitchen, her face drawn and tired.
"Arnie, I think I'll go home. I really can't take much of Manfred. He never stops moving around, never sits still. I can't stand it."
Going up to Arnie, she kissed him on the ear.
"Good night, dear."
"I read about a kid who thought he was a machine," Arnie said. "He had to be plugged in, he said, to work. I mean, you have to be able to stand these fruits. Don't go. Stay for my sake. Manfred's a lot quieter when a woman's around. I don't know why. I have the feeling that Bolin's accomplished nothing. I'm going out there and tell him to his face."
A glass of warm water and baking soda was put into his right hand by his tame bleakman.
"Thanks." He drank it gratefully.
"Jack Bolin," Doreen said, "has done a fine job under difficult conditions. I don't want to hear anything said against him."
She swayed slightly, smiling.
"I'm a little drunk."
"Who isn't?" Arnie said. He put his arm around her waist and hugged her.
"I'm so drunk I'm sick." "Okay, that kid gets me too. Look, I put on that old coated tape. I must be nuts."
Setting down his glass, he unbuttoned the top buttons of her blouse.
"Look away, Helio. Read your book."
The bleakman looked away. Holding Doreen against him, Arnie unbuttoned all the buttons of her blouse and began on her skirt.
"I know they're ahead of me, those earth bastards coming in everywhere you look. My man at the terminal can't even count them anymore. They've been coming in all day long. Let's go to bed."
He kissed her on the collarbone, nuzzled lower and lower until she raised his head with the strength of her hands. In the living room, his hotshot repairman, hired away from Mr. Yee, fiddled with the tape recorder, clumsily putting on a fresh reel. He had knocked over his empty glass.
"What happens if they get there before me?" Arnie Cott asked himself as he clung to Doreen, wheeling slowly about the kitchen with her as Heliogabalus read to himself. "What if I can't buy in at all? Might as well be dead."
He bent Doreen backwards, but all the time thinking, "There has to be a place for me. I love this planet." Music blared. Jack Bolin had gotten the tape going. Doreen pinched him savagely, and he let go of her. He walked from the kitchen, back into the living room, turned down the volume, and said,
"Jack, let's get down to business."
"Right," Jack Bolin agreed.
Coming from the kitchen after him, buttoning her blouse, Doreen made a wide circuit to avoid Manfred, who was down on his hands and knees. The boy had spread out a length of butcher paper and was pasting bits cut from magazines onto it with library paste. Patches of white showed on the rug where he had slopped. Going up to the boy, Arnie bent down close to him and said, "Do you know who I am, Manfred?" There was no answer from the boy, nothing to show he had even heard. "I'm Arnie Cott," Arnie said. "Why don't you laugh or smile sometimes, Manfred? Don't you like to run around and play?" He felt sorry for the boy, sorry and distressed. Jack Boland said in an unsteady, thick voice, "Obviously he doesn't, Arnie, but that's not what concerns us here anyhow." His gaze was befuddled. The hand that held the glass shook. But Arnie continued, "What do you see, Manfred? Let us in on what you see." He waited, but there was only silence. The boy concentrated on his pasting. He had created a collage on the paper, a jagged strip of green, then a perpendicular rise, gray and dense, forbidding. "What's it mean?" Arnie said. "It's a place," Jack said. "A building. I brought it along." He went off, returning with a manila envelope. From it, he brought a large crumpled child's crayon drawing, which he held up for Arnie to examine. "There," Jack said. "That's it. You wanted me to establish communication with him? Well, I established it." He had some trouble with the two long words. His tongue seemed to catch. Arnie, however, did not care how drunk his repairman was. He was accustomed to having his guests tank up. Hard liquor was rare on Mars, and when people came upon it, as they did at Arnie's place, they generally reacted as Jack Boland had. What mattered was the task which Jack had been given. Arnie picked up the picture and studied it. "This it?" he asked Jack. "What else?" "Nothing else." "What about the chamber that slows things down?" "Nothing," Jack said. "Can the boy read the future?" "Absolutely," Jack said. "There's no doubt of it. That picture is proof right there, unless he heard us talking." Turning to Doreen, he said in a slow, thick voice, "Did he hear us, do you think?" "No, you weren't there. It was my dad. I don't think he heard." "Listen, Arnie, you aren't supposed to see this, but I guess it's okay. It's too late now. This is a picture nobody is supposed to see. This is the way it's going to be a century from now, when it's in ruins." "What the hell is it?" Arnie said. "I can't read a kid's nutty drawing. Explain it to me." "This is Amweb," Jack said. "A big, big housing tract. Thousands of people living there. Biggest on Mars. Only it's crumbling into rubble, according to the picture." There was silence. Arnie was baffled. "Maybe you're not interested," Jack said. "Sure I am," Arnie said angrily. He appealed to Doreen, who stood off to one side, looking pensive. "Do you understand this?"
"No, dear," she said.
"Jack," Arnie said, "I called you here for your report, and all I get is this dim-witted drawing. Where is this big housing tract?"
"In the FDR Mountains," Jack said.
Arnie felt his pulse slow, then with difficulty labor on.
"Oh, yeah, I see," he said. "I understand."
Grinning, Jack said,
"I thought you would. You're interested in that. You know, Arnie, you think I'm a schizophrenic, and Doreen thinks so, and my father thinks so, but I do care what your motives are. I can get you plenty of information about the UN project in the FDR Mountains. What else do you want to know about? It's not a power station, and it's not a park. It's in conjunction with the co-op. It's a multiple-unit, infinitely large structure with supermarkets and bakeries, dead center in the Henry Wallace."
"You got all this from the kid?"
"No," Jack said. "From my dad."
They looked at each other a long time.
"Your dad is a speculator?" Arnie said.
"Yes," Jack said. "He just arrived from Earth the other day?"
"Yes," Jack said.
"Jesus," Arnie said to Doreen. "Jesus, it's this guy's father. He's already bought in."
"Yes," Jack said.
"Is there anything left?" Arnie said.
Jack shook his head.
"Oh, Jesus Christ," Arnie said. "And he's on my payroll. I never had such bad luck."
Jack said, I didn't know until just now that this was what you wanted to find out, Arnie.
Yeah, that's true, Arnie said. Speaking to Doreen, he said, I never told him, so it's not his fault.
He aimlessly picked up the boy's drawing.
And this is what it'll look like.
Eventually, Jack said, not at first. To Manfred, Arnie said, you did have the information, but we got it from you too late.
Too late, Jack echoed.
He seemed to understand. He looked stricken.
Sorry, Arnie. I really am sorry. You should have told me.
I don't blame you, Arnie said. We're still friends, Bolin. It's just a case of bad luck. You've been completely honest with me. I can see that. God damn it, sure is too bad.
He's already filed his claim, your dad?
Well, that's the way it goes.
He represents a group of investors, Jack said hoarsely.
Naturally, Arnie said, with unlimited capital. What could I do anyhow? I can't compete. I'm just one guy.
To Manfred, he said, all these people. He pointed to the drawing.
Are they going to live there? Is that it? Is that right, Manfred? Can you see lots of people living there?
His voice rose out of control.
Please, Arnie, Doreen said, calm down. I can see how upset you are, and you shouldn't be.
Raising his head, Arnie said to her in a low voice,
I don't see why this kid never laughs.
The boy suddenly said,
Gubble, gubble.
Yeah, Arnie said with bitterness. That's right. That's real good communication, kid. Gubble, gubble.
To Jack, he said, You have a fine communication established. I can see that. Jack said nothing. Now he looked grim and uneasy.
I can see it's going to take a long time more, Arnie said, to bring this kid out so we can talk to him, right?
Too bad we can't continue. I'm not going any further with it.
No reason why you should, Jack said in a leaden voice.
Right, Arnie said. So that's it. The end of your job.
Doreen said, But you can still use him for...
Oh, of course, Arnie said. I need a skilled repairman anyhow for stuff like that encoder. I got 1,000 items busting down every goddamn day. I just mean this one particular job here. Send him back to BG, this kid. Amweb. Yeah, the co-op buildings get funny names like that. The co-op coming over to Mars. That's a big outfit, that co-op. They'll pay high for their land. They've got the loot. Tell your dad from me that he's a shrewd businessman.
Can we shake hands, Arnie? Jack asked.
Sure, Jack.
Arnie stuck out his hand, and the two of them shook hard and long, looking each other in the eye.
I expect to see a lot of you, Jack. This isn't the end between you and me. It's just the beginning.
He let go of Jack Boland's hand, walked back into the kitchen, and stood by himself, thinking. Presently, Doreen joined him.
That was dreadful news for you, wasn't it? She said, putting her arm around him.
Very bad, Arnie said. Worst I had in a long time. But I'll be okay. I'm not scared of the co-op movement. Lewistown and the water workers were here first, and they'll be here a lot longer. If I'd gotten this project with the Steiner boy started sooner, it would have worked out differently, and I sure don't blame Jack for that.
But inside him, in his heart, he thought, You were working against me, Jack, all the time. You were working with your father. From the start, too. From the day I hired you. He returned to the living room. At the tape transport, Jack stood morose and silent, fooling with the knobs.
Don't take it hard, Arnie said to him.
Thanks, Arnie, Jack said. His eyes were dull. I feel I've let you down.
Not me, Arnie assured him. You haven't let me down, Jack, because nobody lets me down.
On the floor, Manfred Steiner pasted away, ignoring them all. As he flew his father back to the house, leaving the FDR range behind them, Jack thought, Should I show the boy's picture to Arnie? Should I take it to Lewistown and hand it over to him? It's so little. It just doesn't look like what I ought to have produced by now. He knew that tonight he would have to see Arnie in any case.
Very desolate down there, his dad said, nodding toward the desert below. Amazing you people have done so much reclamation work. You should all be proud.
But his attention was actually on his maps. He spoke in a perfunctory manner. It was a formality. Jack snapped on his radio transmitter and called Arnie at Lewistown. Excuse me, Dad, I have to talk to my boss. The radio made a series of noises which attracted Manfred momentarily. He ceased poring over his drawing and raised his head. "I'll take you along," Jack said to the boy. Presently he had Arnie.
"Hi, Jack," Arnie's voice came boomingly. "I've been trying to get a hold of you. Can you—"
"I'll be over to see you tonight," Jack said.
"Not before. How about this afternoon?"
"Afraid tonight is as soon as I can make it," Jack said.
"There—"
He hesitated.
"Nothing to show you until tonight."
If I get near him, he thought, I'll tell him about the UN co-op project. He'll get everything out of me. I'll wait until after my dad's claim has been filed, and then it won't matter.
"Tonight, then," Arnie agreed. "And I'll be on pins, Jack, sitting on pins. I know you're going to come up with something. I got a lot of confidence in you."
Jack thanked him, said goodbye, and rang off.
"Your boss sounds like a gentleman," his dad said after the connection had been broken. "And he certainly looks up to you. I expect you're of priceless value to his organization, a man with your ability."
Jack said nothing. Already he felt guilty.
"Draw me a picture," he said to Manfred, "of how it's going to go tonight, between me and Mr. Cott."
He took away the paper on which the boy was drawing and handed him a blank piece.
"Will you, Manfred? You can see ahead to tonight. You, me, Mr. Cott, at Mr. Cott's place."
The boy took a blue crayon and began to draw. As he piloted the copter, Jack watched. With great care, Manfred drew. At first, Jack could not make it out. Then he grasped what the scene showed. Two men. One was hitting the other in the eye. Manfred laughed, a long, high-pitched, nervous laugh, and suddenly hugged the picture against himself. Feeling cold, Jack turned his attention back to the controls before him. He felt himself perspire, the damp sweat of anxiety. "Is that how it's going to be?" he asked silently within himself. "A fight between me and Arnie, and you will witness it, perhaps, or at least know of it one day."
"Jack," Leo was saying, "you'll take me to the abstract company, won't you? And let me off there? I want to get my papers filed. Can we go right there instead of back to the house? I have to admit I'm uneasy. There must be local operators who are watching all this, and I can't be too careful."
Jack said, "I can only repeat, it's immoral what you're doing."
"Just let me handle it," his father said. "It's my way of doing business, Jack. I don't intend to change."
"Profiteering," Jack said.
"I won't argue it with you," his father said. "It's none of your concern. If you don't feel like assisting me after I've come millions of miles from Earth, I guess I can manage to round up public transportation."
His tone was mild, but he had turned red.
"I'll take you there," Jack said. "I can't stand to be moralized at," his father said.
Jack said nothing. He turned the copter south toward the UN buildings at Pax Grove. Drawing away with his blue crayon, Manfred made one of the two men in his picture, the one who had— Jack saw that, saw the figure become supine, and then still. "Is that me?" he wondered. "Or is it Arnie? Someday, perhaps soon, I will know." Inside Mr. Cott's skin were dead bones, shiny and wet. Mr. Cott was a sack of bones, dirty and yet shiny wet. His head was a skull that took in greens and bit them. Inside him, the greens became rotten things as something ate them to make them dead. Jack Bolin, too, was a dead sack, teeming with gubbish. The outside that fooled almost everyone, it was painted pretty and smelled good, bent down over Miss Anderton, and he saw that. He saw it wanting her in an awful fashion. It poured its wet, sticky self nearer to her, and the dead bug words popped from its mouth. "I love Mozart," Mr. Cott was saying. "I'll put this tape on." He fiddled with the knobs of the amplifier. "Bruno Walter conducting, a great rarity from the golden age of recordings." A hideous racket of screeches and shrieks issued from the speakers like the convulsions of corpses. He shut off the tape transport.
"Sorry," Arnie Cott muttered.
Wincing at the sound, Jack Bolin sniffed the woman's body beside him, saw a shiny perspiration on her upper lip where a faint smear of her lipstick made her mouth look cut. He wanted to bite her lips. He wanted to make blood there. His thumbs wanted to dig into her armpits and make an upward circle so that he worked her breasts. Then he would feel they belonged to him to do with what he wanted. He had made the move already. It was fun.
"What a shock," she said. "You should spare us, Arnie, your sense of humor."
"An accident," Arnie said. He rummaged for another tape. Reaching out his hand, Jack Bolin touched the woman's lap. There was no underwear there beneath her skirt.
He rubbed her legs and she drew her legs up and turned toward him so that her knees pressed into him. She sat like an animal, crouching in expectation. "I can't wait to get you and me out of here and where we can be alone," Jack thought. "God, how I want to feel you and not through clothing." He closed his fingers around her bare ankle and she yapped with pain, smiling at him.
"Listen, Jack," Arnicott said, turning toward him. "I'm sorry."
His words were cut off. Jack did not hear the rest. The woman beside him was telling him something. "Hurry," she was saying. "I can't wait either." Her breath came in short, brisk hisses from her mouth, and she gazed at him fixedly, her face close to his, her eyes huge, as if she were impaled. Neither of them heard Arnie. The room now was silent. Had he missed something, Arnie had said? Jack reached out and took hold of his glass, but there was nothing in it. "Rod of booze," he said, setting it back down on the coffee table.
"God's sake," Arnie said. "I've got to hear how you've done, Jack. Can't you give me anything?"
Still talking, he moved away from the living room into the kitchen. His voice dimmed. Beside Jack, the woman still stared up at him, her mouth weak, as if he were holding her tightly to him, as if she could hardly breathe. "We have to get out of this place and be by ourselves," Jack realized. Then, looking around, he saw that they were alone. Arnie had gone out of the room and could no longer see them. In the kitchen, he was conversing with his tame Bleakman, and so he was already alone with her.
"Not here," Doreen said.
But her body fluttered. It did not resist him as he squeezed her about the waist. She did not mind being squashed because she wanted to, too. She could not hold back either.
"Yes," she said, "but hurry."
Her nails dug into his shoulders and she shut her eyes tight, moaning and shuddering.
"At the side," she said, "it unbuttons my skirt."
Bending over her, he saw her languid, almost rotting beauty fall away. Yellow cracks spread through her teeth, and the teeth split and sank into her gums, which in turn became green and dry like leather. And then she coughed and spat up into his face quantities of dust. The gubbler had gotten her, he realized, before he had been able to. So he let her go. She settled backward, her breaking bones making little sharp splintering sounds. Her eyes fused over, opaque, and from behind one eye the lashes became the furry probing feet of a thick-haired insect stuck back there wanting to get out. Its tiny pinhead red eye peeped past the loose rim of her unseeing eye, and then withdrew. After that the insect squirmed, making the dead eye of the woman bulge. And then for an instant the insect peered through the lens of her eye, looking this way and that, saw him but was unable to make out who or what he was. It could not fully make use of the decayed mechanism behind which it lived. Like overripe puffballs, her boobies wheezed as they deflated into flatness, and from their dry interiors, through the web of cracks spreading across them, a cloud of spores arose and drifted up into his face, the smell of mold and age of the gubbler, who had come and inhabited the inside long ago and was now working his way out to the surface. The dead mouth twitched, and then from deep inside, at the bottom of the pipe, which was the throat, a voice muttered, "You weren't fast enough." And then the head fell off entirely, leaving the white pointed stick-like end of the neck projecting. Jack released her, and she folded up into a little dried-up heap of flat, almost transparent plates, like the discarded skin of a snake, almost without weight. He brushed them away from him with his hand. And at the same time, to his surprise, he heard her voice from the kitchen.
"Arnie, I think I'll go home. I really can't take much of Manfred. He never stops moving around, never sits still."
Turning his head, he saw her in there with Arnie standing very close to him. She kissed him on the ear.
"Good night, dear," she said.
"I read about a kid who thought he was a machine," Arnie said, and then the kitchen door shut. Jack could neither hear nor see them.
Rubbing his forehead, he thought, "I really am drunk. What's wrong with me? My mind splitting." He blinked, tried to gather his faculties. On the rug, not far from the couch, Manfred Steiner cut out a picture from a magazine with blunt scissors, smiling to himself. The paper rustled as he cut it, a sound that distracted Jack and made it even more difficult for him to put in focus his wandering attention. From beyond the kitchen door he heard heavy breathing and then labored prolonged grunts. "What are they doing?" he asked himself. "The three of them, she and Arnie and the tame Bleakman, together?" The grunts became slower and then ceased. There was no sound at all. "I wish I was home," Jack said to himself with desperate, utter confusion. "I want to get out of here, but how?" He felt weak and terribly sick, and he remained on the couch where he was, unable to break away, to move or think.
A voice in his mind said, "Gubble, gubble, gubble. I am gubble, 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 gubble." "Stop," he said to it. "Gubble, gubble, gubble, gubble," it answered. Dust fell on him from the walls. The room creaked with age and dust, rotting around him. "Gubble, gubble, gubble," the room said. "The gubbler is here to gubble, gubble you and make you into gubbish." Getting unsteadily to his feet, he managed to walk step by step over to Arnie's amplifier and tape recorder. He picked up a reel of tape and got the box open. After several faulty, feeble efforts, he succeeded in putting it on the spindle of the transport. The door to the kitchen opened a crack, and an eye watched him. He could not tell whose it was. "I have to get out of here," Jack Boland said to himself. "Or fight it off. I have to break this, throw it away from me, or be eaten. It is eating me up." He twisted the volume control convulsively so that the music blared up and deafened him, roared through the room, spilling over the walls, the furniture, lashing at the ajar kitchen door, attacking everyone and everything in sight. The kitchen door fell forward, its hinges breaking. It crashed over, and a thing came hurriedly sideways from the kitchen, dislodged into belated activity by the roar of the music. The thing scrabbled up to him and past him, feeling for the volume control knob. The music ebbed. But he felt better. He felt sane once more, thank God. Jack Boland dropped his father off at the abstract office and then, with Manfred, flew on to Lewistown, to Doreen Anderton's apartment. When she opened the door and saw him, she said, "What is it, Jack?" She quickly held the door open and he and Manfred went on inside. "It's going to be very bad tonight," he told her.
"Are you sure?"
She seated herself across from him.
"Do you have to go at all?"
"Yes, I suppose so.
But maybe you're wrong."
Jack said, "Manfred has already told me. He's already seen it."
"Don't be scared," Doreen said softly.
"But I am," he said.
"Why will it be bad?"
"I don't know. Manfred couldn't tell me that."
"But," she gestured, "you've made contact with him. That's wonderful. That's what Arnie wants."
"I hope you'll be there," Jack said.
"Yes, I'll be there, but there's not much I can do.
Is my opinion worth anything?"
"Because I'm positive that Arnie will be pleased. I think you're having an anxiety attack for no reason."
"It's the end," Jack said, "between me and Arnie, tonight. I know it, and I don't know why." He felt sick to his stomach. "It almost seems to me that Manfred does more than know the future. In some way, he controls it. He can make it come out the worst possible way because that's what seems natural to him. That's how he sees reality. It's as if by being around him we're sinking into his reality. It's starting to seep over us and replace our own way of viewing things, and the kind of events we're accustomed to see come about now somehow don't come about. It's not natural for me to feel this way. I've never had this feeling about the future before."
He was silent then.
"You've been around him too much," Doreen said. "Tendencies in you that are..." She hesitated.
"Unstable tendencies, Jack.
Allied to his. You were supposed to draw him into our world, the shared reality of our society. Instead, hasn't he drawn you into his own? I don't think there's any precognition. I think it's been a mistake from the start. It would be better if you got out of it, if you left that boy."
She glanced toward Manfred, who had gone to the window of her apartment to stare out at the street below.
"If you didn't have anything more to do with him."
"It's too late for that," Jack said.
"You're not a psychotherapist or a doctor," Doreen said. "It's one thing for Milton Glaub to be in close contact day after day with autistic and schizophrenic persons, but you? You're a repairman who blundered into this because of a crazy impulse on Arnie's part. You just happened to be there in the same room with him fixing his encoder, and so you wound up with this. You shouldn't be so passive, Jack. You're letting your life be shaped by chance, and for God's sake, don't you recognize that passivity for what it is?"
After a pause, he said, "I suppose I do."
"Say it."
He said, "There's a tendency for a schizophrenic individual to be passive, I know that."
"Be decisive. Don't go any further with this. Call Arnie and tell him you're simply not competent to handle Manfred. He should be back at Camp BG where Milton Glaub can work with him. They can build that slowed-down chamber there. They were starting to, weren't they?"
"They'll never get around to it. They're talking about importing the equipment from home. You know what that means."
"And you'll never get around to it," Doreen said, "because long before you do, you'll have cracked up mentally. I can look into the future, too. You know what I see? I see you having a much more serious collapse than ever before. I see total psychological collapse for you, Jack, if you keep working on this. Already you're being mauled by acute schizophrenic anxiety, by panic. Isn't that so? Isn't it? He nodded. I saw that in my brother, Doreen said. Schizophrenic panic, and once you see it break out in a person, you can never forget it. The collapse of their reality around them, the collapse of their perceptions of time and space, cause and effect. And isn't that what's happening to you? You're talking as if this meeting with Arnie can't be altered by anything you do. And that's a deep regression on your part from adult responsibility and maturity. That's not like you at all. Breathing deeply, her chest rising and falling painfully, she went on. I'll call Arnie and tell him you're pulling out, and he'll have to get someone else to finish with Manfred. And I'll tell him that you've made no progress, that it's pointless for you and for him to continue with this. I've seen Arnie get these whims before. He keeps them percolating for a few days or weeks, and then he forgets them. He can forget this. Jack said, he won't forget this one. Try, she said. No, he said. I have to go there tonight and give him my progress report. I said I would. I owe it to him. You're a damn fool, Doreen said. I know it, Jack said, but not for the reason you think. I'm a fool because I took on a job without looking ahead to its consequences. He broke off. Maybe it is what you said. I'm not competent to work with Manfred. That's it, period. But you're still going ahead. What do you have to show Arnie tonight? Show it to me right now. Getting out a manila envelope, Jack reached into it and drew out the picture of the buildings which Manfred had drawn. For a long time, Doreen studied it, and then she handed it back to him. That's an evil and sick drawing, she said in a voice almost inaudible. I know what it is. It's the tomb world, isn't it? That's what he's drawn, the world after death. And that's what he sees, and through him that's what you're beginning to see. You want to take that to Arnie? You have lost your grip on reality. Do you think Arnie wants to see an abomination like that? Burn it. It's not that bad, he said, deeply perturbed by her reaction. Yes, it is, Doreen said. And it's a dreadful sign that it doesn't strike you that way. Did it at first? He had to nod yes. Then you know I'm right, she said. I have to go on, he said. I'll see you at his place tonight. Going over to the window, he tapped Manfred on the shoulder. We have to go now. We'll see this lady tonight and Mr. Cott, too. Goodbye, Jack, Doreen said, accompanying him to the door. Her large dark eyes were heavy with despair. There's nothing I can say to stop you. I can see that. You've changed. You're so less alive now than you were just a day or so ago. Do you know that? No, he said. I didn't realize that. But he was not surprised to hear it. He could feel it, hanging heavy over his limbs, choking his heart. Leaning toward her, he kissed her on her full, good-tasting lips. I'll see you tonight. She stood at the doorway, silently watching him and the boy go. In the time remaining before evening, Jack Boland decided to drop by the public school and pick up his son.